Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, March 11, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we'll be giving you an update on the latest happenings at the CFPB. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're monitoring this call and recording it for use as a podcast in the future. Our guests today both have been with us before, but we're very happy to welcome them back. We're especially happy to welcome both of them back. The Honorable Wayne A. Abernathy. He's Executive Vice President for Financial Institutions Policy and Regulatory Affairs at the American Bankers Association. He's also the Chairman of the Federalist Society's Financial Services Practice Group. He'll be joined by Professor Todd J. Zawicki. He's the Foundation Professor of Law at George Mason University School of Law, and he, too, is a member of the Financial Services Executive Committee of the Federalist Society. They're going to address a number of topics in order, but as always, we'll be taking questions from the audience, so please be due ready for that opportunity to ask questions when we get to that part of the program. But for now, let me turn things over to Wayne Abernathy.
Thank you very much, Dean, and thank you to everybody who's listening in to us this morning or this afternoon, depending on which part of the country you're currently residing in. It's a pleasure to be able to present to you some of the operations of the Bureau in the last month. I want to give a particular call out to Jerry Lozier, who is of counsel with Winston & Strawn, who has done a lot of the research and spade work to put together the information that we will be sharing with you today. This is one in a series, what has become a series of updates on the activities of the new Consumer Bureau. I think this might be fourth or fifth in our series. This is a bureau that, amongst government agencies, this is one of the most active and to some degree is in hyperdrive in laying out at least new issues and new topics for us to look at and to concern both consumers and the providers of financial services alike. Today we'll be going through a few of the more than two dozen items that have transpired or affecting the Bureau over the past month, up through as recently as yesterday. So without any more introduction, let me now turn to my colleague here, Todd Zawicki, who is going to take up the first issue dealing with the arbitration study by the Consumer Bureau. Todd.
Hi, Wayne. Hi, everybody. Yes, this first issue is hot off the presses. It just came out yesterday. There was a field hearing where, a presentation where the Bureau released its final report on arbitration that it's been working on for a while. The whole thing is 700 pages long. Obviously, I haven't digested the whole thing. Be interested in comments from those listening in, as well on things that they may have picked up, because obviously that something that thick and that data intensive is going to require some time to digest. So I'm going to give sort of my initial impressions on it, and would be interested in hearing what other people might have to share on it. As part of Dodd-Frank did a couple things with respect to arbitration. First, it actually banned arbitration clauses in mortgage contracts. And it also, under Section 1028A of Dodd-Frank, instructed the CFPB to do a study of arbitrations and to potentially consider arbitration clauses, pre-dispute arbitration clauses in consumer credit contracts, and to potentially suggest regulations based on it. In December 2013, the Bureau released its preliminary report on arbitration clauses, and then yesterday released a much bigger final report. And the report that came out yesterday has a lot of data in it, and also has some fairly dubious conclusions based on the data. The data itself is very useful. They start off simply by getting information on the prevalence of arbitration clauses in a variety of different products, credit cards, checking accounts, prepaid cards, student loans, payday loans, and mobile wireless providers. And they find that that they vary across these, but that at least some prepaid cards, generally most of those have arbitration clauses in them. Checking accounts, for instance, rarely do not. Only 8% of banks and credit unions actually include arbitration clauses in their checking account agreements, but most of the large banks do. Same thing with credit cards. And so what we do see is, although this is a chronic problem, the CFPB obviously, is that their press releases and their summaries don't always match what is actually in their reports. What we find is that there is some variety in markets, that larger banks tend to use them more frequently, that there are some markets such as prepaid cards and payday loans where they are pretty ubiquitous, others such as checking accounts where relatively few institutions use them, although the large institutions do, and that's more or less the same with credit cards. As they work through it, basically the crux of the article or the report turns on two basic ideas, which is the first is a sort of running comparison between arbitration clauses as a way of granting relief to consumers who feel like they've been aggrieved versus class actions, and the second is what the overall impact on this is. And the general thrust of the report is quite negative towards arbitration agreements. Basically what they conclude based on their analysis is that that consumers don't bring very many arbitration clauses, which they take as evidence implicitly that arbitration is not a viable means of consumers to be able to get redress when they feel like they've been wronged by an institution, that they just for whatever reason consumers do not tend to arbitrate. I'm working on a comment on this right now, which hopefully will be out in the next few weeks, but and I could give more elaboration at that point. But one thing that they quite clearly do not do here is consider other reasons, for example, why it may be that there's a relatively small number of arbitrations. So, for instance, many banks have internal dispute resolution processes, which are very effective at dealing with small dollar complaints, especially if they are worthwhile complaints, meritorious complaints. And so unless you know how often banks resolve these disputes before they ever end up getting to a conflict or arbitration, you can't necessarily draw the conclusion that arbitration is not a useful way for consumers to be able to get redress in these situations. Nevertheless, they paint a picture of consumer arbitration as very ineffective at providing relief to consumers. By contrast, they paint a remarkably, and I'd say somewhat unique, uniquely positive view of class actions, considering that over time, what most people have come to believe is that there's very little enthusiasm nowadays in most quarters for class actions. One reading this report will find a quite a contrary voice, which is they paint a very positive view of class actions. As they say, at least 160 million class members were eligible for relief in federal consumer finance class actions over the five-year period studied. The settlements totaled $2.7 billion in cash, in-kind relief expenses and fees, and claimed that only 18% went to attorney's fees and expenses. And they say that does not include the potential value of companies changing their behavior. This is going to take time for people to digest exactly what they are doing here, but it certainly is startling in the current environment to see such a rosy picture of class actions. And what they're reporting here seems to be quite contrary to what other studies have found about class actions more generally. But also, obviously, implied in this is that all these class actions are meritorious. That there apparently are no sort of basically settlements that are just to settle nuisance suits and the like in this particular the assumptions here. And so it's quite a startling conclusion for the positive picture that the Bureau paints of class actions. And I suspect that I certainly know people will be going over that data to see whether or not whether it's actually representative. More importantly, and related to that, is then one of the things that's excluded, of course, in just counting up the benefits, is what are the potential costs of class actions, which is, it's one thing to simply give money away to consumers, and if that's all you count up, but the concern, obviously, of class actions is that it's imposing costs on businesses in terms of nuisance suits and payments to consumers. And here, the Bureau does anticipate that and does a relatively unique piece of research, which is they conclude as well that, as they put it, there is no evidence that arbitration clauses lead to lower prices for consumers. They use a methodology basically of dealing with a settlement to class action a few years ago, which led several banks to stop including arbitration clauses temporarily for a 3.5-year period in their contracts. The CFPB then tried to take the new credit card issuances issued by the banks subject to the settlement agreement and contrast that with banks. And so they did not have arbitration clauses. Contrast that with banks that did continue to have arbitration clauses. And what the CFPB concluded was that the banks that had temporarily excluded arbitration agreements from their contracts did not reduce prices and did not reduce access to credit during that period. The CFPB then goes on to basically argue that the reason for that is that most consumers do not know that they have arbitration clauses in their credit card contracts, and that many of those basically many consumers did not know either that they had an arbitration clause or what the arbitration clause meant. And obviously the picture they are presenting is that the consumers do not shop on the basis of whether or not a card has an arbitration agreement or not. And so as a result, the cost savings, if there were any, are not passed through to consumers. And obviously the CFPB is pointing in the direction of basically saying that that this is, to put it bluntly, just the way that the banks are ripping people off and not giving them anything in exchange for it, while at the same time presenting a very rosy picture of class action cases as a more viable way of getting consumer redress. So as many anticipated, the report, I believe the Chamber of Commerce said, seems to have the flavor of something where the conclusions were written in advance, and then everybody knew basically where they were headed with this, and it turns out what they've actually presented is consistent with where everyone thought that they were headed. Now, the anomaly here is if that's true, that consumers don't know about it, what they still do not provide any explanation for is why some banks have them and some do not, why it would be that we see such diversity in these markets, and the like. But many people are interpreting this as the first step towards essentially justifying a regulatory ban on class action or on arbitration clauses in many of these type of consumer products, just as they did with mortgages in Dodd-Frank. So that's a fairly extended summary, but I'll throw it back to you now, Wayne.
Yeah, thank you very much, Todd. Now, as I understand, Dodd-Frank, all it requires the Bureau to do is this study. So having done the study, the Bureau has met its obligation under Dodd-Frank on arbitration. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. That's what Section 1028A of Dodd-Frank says, is that they have to do the study, but it doesn't say what to do next.
And the study itself doesn't point very much in the direction of where they might go. I think you pointed out one of their remedies for whatever they find in their study may be that they ban. I was talking to somebody yesterday who's more familiar with the broker-dealer world, and he was suggesting that another avenue they may take is what's happened with broker-dealer arbitration, where the arbitration rules are significantly tilted in favor of investors as opposed to broker-dealers. So that's something they could do alternatively to just banning. Is that, would you think
it could be one of the anomalies about arbitration is that while and this came out actually quite clearly in the preliminary report on arbitration, is that the arbitration, when consumers actually arbitrate, they get a pretty fair deal, which is they win about half the cases involving arbitration. The CFPB reported at that time that something like 60% of consumers were actually represented by attorneys in arbitration. So that it seems quite clearly, you know, in perhaps in contrast to the broker-dealer thing, it's quite clear that when cases are actually arbitrated, consumers are getting a are represented, and that they've got at least a 50% likelihood of winning, which is exactly what you would expect in a standard situation. And so what the thrust of the argument here has been that essentially that arbitration is too expensive relative to the cost of the consumer. So it may be that they might move in the direction that you suggest, Wayne, but it strikes me that they're headed more in the direction of basically saying that we need class action cases to basically mop up a lot of these relatively small disputes that that consumers don't feel like they have enough incentive to arbitrate. Now, of course, one of the other aspects of that is that arbitration is becoming cheaper all the time. Now, technology, for instance, video, use of video and that sort of thing makes it even easier for consumers to arbitrate than they might have in the past. So one possibility, as you suggest, it would be to make arbitration cheaper and easier, but their emphasis on how wonderful class action cases are here suggests to me that that's the direction that they're moving in.
And, of course, this is just an early chapter in a long book that's going to continue to unfold as we go forward. We certainly will be happy to field any questions or comments that people may have on this topic when we get to the Q&A portion of our discussion today. If I could bring up the next issue, and we do want to go through a handful to put on the table for you today. When the Bureau was created, and this goes into the interesting structure of the Consumer Bureau and the argument that there's not a whole lot of oversight there, curiously, the law, Dodd-Frank Act, did not provide for an inspector general for the Consumer Bureau. But also part of the interesting way that the Bureau was created, it is a bureau of the Federal Reserve Board. And therefore, the inspector general of the Federal Reserve Board has jurisdiction to investigate activities at the Bureau. I think there was a lot of skepticism when the law was passed that the Federal Reserve IG would really be interested in going after the Bureau, that it would focus most of their attention on activities of the Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve system itself. Curiously, though, on February 10th, the Inspector General for the Federal Reserve released its current work plan, and there are some very significant topics that the Inspector General is already looking into. For example, the IG of the Fed is looking at the means by which the Bureau manages its contracts. They're looking at the diversity and inclusion processes at the Bureau. And very curiously, looking at one issue that has come under significant criticism on Capitol Hill and elsewhere, and that is the renovation costs for the Bureau's new headquarters, which have, I think, doubled or if not tripled initial estimates, and they're still going up. Another criticism that has been raised to the Bureau is how they manage the enormous consumer database that the Bureau has been gathering and putting together, and how they manage the confidentiality and the other details with preserving the integrity of that huge database. Presumably there is significant information on a number of consumers there, and making sure that that information is protected in a way that doesn't allow bad actors to get at that information and engage in identity theft and other kinds of things is a very important issue. They're also looking, the IG is also looking at how the Bureau has been distributing the funds that it collects in its civil penalty fund. One of the provisions of Dodd-Frank says to the Bureau, the penalties that you're collecting from the bad doers that you've identified in your enforcement actions go into a fund, and the Bureau is then supposed to disperse those funds to victims and where you cannot identify the victims, then it's supposed to be used for investor education and related kind of processes. There's been a lot of worry that that really creates an opportunity for benefiting cronies and other friends of the Bureau. And it's very, valuable to see that the Inspector General is going to look at how those funds are distributed. Those are some of the existing projects that the IG is looking at. They also indicate that some of their planned projects that they will be taking up include how the enforcement office processes their confidential information and the enforcement activities, and also looking at the Bureau's compliance with requirements for issuing civil investigative demands. So some very interesting issues there as well. So we're looking forward to what the product of the Inspector General has been. It certainly seems in terms of topics to be a very active agenda. Now we'll need to see what the IG finds. Let me turn now to Todd to talk about payday lending.
A few weeks ago, the New York Times reported, and other outlets reported as well, is that the CFPB is moving towards long-anticipated rules on payday loans. And the hostility towards payday loans has obviously been very high the past few years, most notably with Operation Choke Point. But it's been generally considered that the CFPB has had payday loans in their crosshairs for some time. And what the report suggests is that they might move in the direction of imposing ability to repay requirements and perhaps limits on rollovers. Now, the interesting thing about that is that there really seems to be very little empirical evidence to support those sorts of limits on payday loans. And the more recent empirical evidence that's come out that looks more specifically at some of these questions has generally cast doubt on the wisdom of regulating payday loans. Just a couple things that came out recently was a really excellent article by Ronald Mann at Columbia Law School. And what he found was his article is Do Defaults on Payday Loans Matter? And what he found is that payday loan defaults do not materially affect credit scores when people end up defaulting on payday loans. And in fact, another article, Payday Loan Rollovers of Consumer Welfare, by Professor Jennifer Lewis Priestley of Kennesaw State University, found that borrowers with higher numbers of rollovers experienced more improvements in the credit scores than borrowers with fewer rollovers. And so what we're finding now, what we found for a very long time, is that the data on payday loans is very mixed. Some people find that they can be welfare improving, quite welfare improving. That's certainly consistent with this more recent research. Some people have found some evidence that they are not. The curiosity about payday loans, of course, is that when a consumer decides to roll over a payday loan, it's essentially voluntary because payday lenders really never sue to collect against somebody who, or rarely sue to collect against somebody who defaults on a payday loan. So they're very odd products. They actually tend to be very small amounts of from most borrowers' monthly income. And so one of the reasons I think that it's been hard to find real welfare effects, negative welfare effects from payday loans is for those various reasons, which is that the consequences of default tend to be small, and the cost for most borrowers who are middle class or lower middle class is relatively small. Also, of course, as the CFPB has written on this, they still have not addressed the question of if you take away payday loans, what happens to people who are using payday loans, which was originally what they said was going to be something that they were going to look into, but to date still have not. Regardless of all that, it appears that the CFPB is moving towards some sort of rulemaking in the relatively near future on payday loans, so keep posted on that. And most people expect that it'll probably, the betting money is it'll probably be fairly harsh. So back to you, Wayne.
Thank you very much, Todd. Another issue that we're going to look at is the Bureau and its efforts to be ever helpful to consumers. Several weeks ago, published what it calls a mortgage rate tool on the Bureau's website. You can go there and find information, data that will help you, according to the Bureau, to identify what the prevailing mortgage rates are in your particular community so that when you're shopping for a mortgage, you can figure out what the best deal is. There's been a lot of criticism about the source of the information that the Bureau publishes and its usefulness. And most recently, in a February 16 article in the Huffington Post, professor of finance emeritus from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, Jack Gutenberg, who I'm told is often referred to as the mortgage professor, wrote a scathing article of the Bureau's new mortgage rate tool. He, in essence, calls it, quote, completely useless. And he advises consumers to, quote, ignore this particular tool. Some of the criticisms that Professor Gutenberg refers to is that he points out, first of all, the data that the Bureau uses to develop its tool does not represent or reflect the actual competitiveness of the market. It's limited information. And I think one of the most damning criticisms is he points out that the information is always stale. He points out that the Bureau refreshes its data in the morning when actually the rates usually change overnight, so that by the time the Bureau actually publishes the information, it's already on the verge of being overcome by the latest round of information based upon when the rates are set by the various providers of mortgage loans. Then some of the other criticisms, he points out that the mortgage tool does not take into account various fixed fees that go into the actual price and total cost to the consumer. They don't look into other specific kinds of costs that are involved, so you don't get a complete picture. It doesn't apply to the many different ways in which people buy mortgage properties and take out loans against them. It doesn't differentiate between whether it's a loan for a condo or a refi, or whether it's for a second home, or that there may be some tax and other insurance escrow issues involved with it. He points out that not only does it not include any of these things, but the Bureau's website itself doesn't point out that it doesn't include these things. As someone that I talked to said, the Bureau would probably fail any provider of mortgage information that put forward information in this way that the Bureau does itself as providing misleading information. So in the process of trying to help consumers, the Bureau seems to have put out a consumer tool that is clearly misleading. Now back to you, Todd, to talk about credit reporting agencies.
Credit reporting agencies have been something that's been on the CFPB's radar for a while. And you may recall last year they released some studies on healthcare debt, medical debt, on credit reporting and credit scores, which they claimed that they had essentially a better model of the prediction of medical debt. And they've continued to advocate on that. They've pushed, and many people may have noticed, that many credit cards now are making people's FICO scores available to them. People are getting more information about FICO scores and that sort of thing. In the past month, one important development on that is not so much the CFPB, but the state of New York and the New York Attorney General entered into a an agreement with the credit reporting agencies, really focused on medical bills. It's not a major thing with respect to the details, but it is indicative of continued scrutiny of credit reporting agencies. Basically, what they agreed to was that there's apparently a particular problem with the reporting of medical debt, which is that because of the convoluted insurance process and possible delays, sometimes bills end up being reported for collection simply because the insurance hasn't been cleared. Consumers don't know what's going on and that sort of thing. And so what was entered into with the New York AG, but which is basically going to apply nationwide, is that from now on there will be a 180-day waiting period before the credit reporting agencies post medical bills on somebody's credit report, basically the idea being to allow insurance to clear, and then they have to be specially attentive to removing it afterwards. Now, one of the peculiarities about this is that the The state AG, Attorney General Schneiderman, had a quote that said about the credit reporting agencies, they are going to have to hire a lot of people and it's going to cost a substantial amount of money, which is sort of an unusual sort of approach. I'm not sure if that was the representative quote, but he seemed to suggest that simply imposing new costs on the credit reporting agencies was something good without any connection to any possible benefits as a result of it. And I think that what the idea here is that monitoring medical bills to remove them once the insurance is paid is, I suspect, where he has in mind that there will be a lot of effort and energy. This is obviously a big issue. Medical debt is a particular hobby horse of Senator Warren, and this has been an issue that Democrats have been following for a long time, and I think that this is partly what this is. Finally, they claimed that about half of all unpaid collections are related to medical debt, which was something that was reported. I'm not quite sure where that came from, but this is, according to them, this is a very large problem. And that's all I have on that, Wayne.
Thank you very much, Todd. And we'll turn to just one more issue before we open up the floor to questions from our audience. This addresses a concern that I've heard from a number of people and read about, complaints that people have had that the Bureau, in writing their rules and regulations and taking some of their actions, is not taking into account adequately the administrative burdens involved with the Bureau's various activities. And yet on February 19th, we found a very important point where the Bureau has taken specific action to relieve administrative burden. On that day, on February 19th, the Bureau proposed a regulation to suspend, at least temporarily for 1 year, a requirement that credit card issuers send their card agreements to the Bureau every quarter for the Bureau to post on its website. The various card agreements would have to be sent. The Bureau would then process them and put them on the website and post them for all to see. Well, the Bureau is proposing to suspend that at least for a year, although the credit card issuers would have to continue to post their agreements on their own websites, but they wouldn't send it to the Bureau. Now, the relief here is the administrative burden that is being imposed, quote, on the administrative burden of its own staff. The Bureau is concerned that all of this information is just too much of a burden for the Bureau staff to handle, and until they can get their arms around it, they're relieving that responsibility for a year. So at least the Bureau is recognizing administrative burdens and recognizing that perhaps that burden begins at home. Well, that's progress. And at that point, Dean, I think we're willing to pause and open the floor up to questions from our callers on these issues or others that they'd like to raise.
Terrific. Thank you, gentlemen. And as Wayne Abernathy suggests, I guess the floor will be open to questions on anything financial services related. So in a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. While we're waiting to see who might ring in, let me just make a quick programming announcement about our upcoming Teleform conference call schedule. Tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be talking about the heckler's veto, the sort of the intersection of free speech and religion. And then next week, we have various calls in development, including one on judicial deference. But do check in on our website because the schedule is very fluid. We've got two callers now with questions. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first call of the day.
On, you have the floor.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, I have two quick questions. With respect to Dodd-Frank, does the ban on arbitration clauses apply retroactively in mortgage agreements?
Mm-hmm. Todd, you want to take that up?
That's a good question. I do not recall whether it applied retroactively. The mortgages were in place at that time. Do you know the answer to that, Wayne?
I don't. Mortgage is not a specialty of mine, unfortunately, and I wish I could have the answer. Perhaps there's someone listening in that has an answer to that question and can help us out with that. That is a very important question. Go ahead.
One other question then. Arbitration clauses. Do they always, sometimes, never preclude appeal to the courts?
Very good question. You're talking about arbitration clauses in general.
Yeah, well, in mortgage agreements, but in general, yes.
In general, they preclude, yes. In general, and that's what the crux of the, you may recall, the AT&T versus Concepcion case a few years ago that the Supreme Court decided basically enforce these things. And that's exactly right, is that they generally preclude appeal to courts other than to simply enforce the arbitrator's agreements. It's my
understanding. Okay, so if they did not do that, you'd have a totally different situation, which could stand without impeding anyone's possibility of going to class action or individual suit.
Well, the deal with arbitration is it only makes sense if it's binding, because basically what you would otherwise get is a problem where the whole system would unravel. So, for instance, there's some evidence on arbitrations versus litigation, and we don't have a lot of good evidence on this, but some data suggests, for instance, that consumers are more likely to win in arbitrations than in class actions, but in litigation, but for similar type cases. But when they litigate, they win more. And so basically, you know, what the evidence tends to suggest is it's sort of regular arbitration versus litigation, is that arbitration is less expensive, but that the consumers who think they have a particularly good case will litigate. And so basically what you would have is a problem where people who thought they had a good case would litigate and people who otherwise would arbitrate. And so if you allow the consumer to choose, then it sort of removes the value of the arbitration clause.
Wouldn't you also, Todd, all you'd be doing is just adding one more layer that you have to work your way through in terms of various appeal stages before you get to a final decision?
That's right. That's right. And right. That's exactly right. Also, Wayne.
All right. Thank you.
Good questions. Yeah. Thank you. And again, if there's anyone who can help us out with an answer to the first question that was posed, certainly do call in, and I would be glad to let you share the floor with us on that point. Next call.
You can do that by pushing the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending. Take that question now.
Go ahead.
Yes, this is Stephen Vaden. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I had a question regarding the CFPB's information gathering ability, namely that the statutes give the CFPB the ability to request information from various parties that they can regulate. And I was wondering if either of you were aware of any instance in which a party had refused to turn over information that the CFPB requested, or whether the CFPB has ever tried to use any sort of compulsory process in order to get at information that it feels it needs.
I'm not sure I can give you a definitive answer, but I can give the answer of various cases that I am aware of. I know that in most cases, and this deals with banks and other financial institutions, where the Bureau has wanted information, there has often been a back and forth with regard to the request, trying to narrow their request, trying to get it more focused. And after a series of back and forth exercises, the information has been provided. I'm not aware of any financial institutions that have refused to provide information, and the Bureau has had to resort to an enforcement action. But I wouldn't say that there aren't any of cases. I'm just not aware of any particular, other than outside of enforcement action. Now, enforcement actions, there very well may have been some subpoena efforts. Todd, are you aware of any?
No, but the other place that they often collect data from is just a byproduct from their supervisory function. So they collect a bunch of information basically through supervision, and then they use it. And that can be a problem. So, for instance, in overdraft protection, since they supervise directly the larger banks, they have an unrepresentative sample of how overdraft protection gets used, because they have an unrepresentative sample of banks. And so a lot of times it's just information that's collected through those purposes that they then reconfigure for their research and other purposes.
Now, I will say there's another interesting legal issue in connection with all of their information gathering authority. While the law is very broad in giving them the authority to ask for information, to obtain information, to gather it, it doesn't. It very rarely gives them authority to publish that information, and yet the Bureau is trying to assert that their authority to gather information includes the authority to publish that information, that is going to be a very serious and significant legal issue going forward. One of the most significant areas in dispute right now, and that is with regard to consumer complaint information. The Bureau does have authority to gather consumer complaint information, is directed to do that. But the law seems to have been very clear in not giving them authority to publish it, yet they're publishing that information nevertheless, and that could become a very significant legal dispute going forward.
And Wayne, when you you mentioned earlier about the IG overlooking the CFPB, and one of the things that's been a chronic criticism that the CFPB by the GAO has been inadequate data security processes, especially with respect to consumer information and consumer security. And when they're collecting such massive amounts of information, and they seem to there was a hearing on this a little while ago where they wanted to collect, I think, 85% of credit cards and 90% of mortgage accounts in the country, while at the same time they're on consumers, while at the same time they're being criticized for failure to adequately protect consumer data. One would think that that they would trim their requests to only what they need that's necessary. Instead, they basically ask for everything, even though that raises threats to consumers that of a security breach that might compromise their personal information.
And a very lucrative potential security breach, given the kind of information that they would be gathering and how much of it would be put all in one place.
Very good point, yes.
Yeah, good question. Has really elicited a number of issues, but really appreciate you raising that.
Once again, if you have a question, yeah, push the star button and then the pound button if you have a question. Our lines are wide open right now. While we're waiting to see if anybody else rings in, let me, this is Dean Reuter, let me ask a question of perhaps Professor Zawicki about the arbitration study. You mentioned, I think, that it was done pursuant to the text of Dodd-Frank, and we're not sure what's going to happen next in terms of next steps. I'm wondering if there's anything in the text of Dodd-Frank that suggests that the study is to be done so that CFPB can regulate from that point forward, or is the study supposed to be done so that CFPB can just report back to Congress and maybe Congress can then act? Is there any suggestion one way or another in the text of Dodd-Frank?
I don't believe the text necessarily suggests it one way or another. Consumer advocates, when that section was unveiled, 1028A, said at the time that they saw where it was headed. One suspects that, considering they got the ban on mortgages, one suspects that the 2009 Congress was pointing in a particular direction, but I don't believe the text of the statute itself tells them they're supposed to do anything about it, but perhaps Wayne remembers differently.
Well, Dean, your question actually reminds me of the what I thought of a very interesting statement made by Senator Dodd when the Bureau was added to the bill. You might recall that the Bureau was not part of one of the original parts of the bill, was added in there. When it was done, he gave a press conference and he said, once we enact this and create this Bureau, we will never have to go to Congress again to enact consumer protection statutes. And I thought that pretty astonishing for a member of Congress to say, but I think that suggests that their view was the Bureau would take care of business.
Interesting.
Yeah, and this has obviously been a stalking horse. You know, the politics of this are not exactly difficult, which is class action attorneys are a very big Democratic Party constituency and donate a lot of money. They were very close to Director Cordray when he was Attorney General of Ohio. And obviously, these cases are very easy cases to aggregate into class actions and bring very large suits, and a lot of these regulations are in laws are the kind of things that are very easy to bring lawsuits on, even without having to show any real harm to consumers. So, for example, in the report that we're working on, turns out there were about half the class action cases in Chicago over a 3-year period involves simply the way in which placards were posted outside of ATM machines, disclosing the fees. They were reported on the screen, but the placards had been torn off at some point, and the lawyers just basically went around taking pictures of the the ATM machines with the placards off, and then basically created class action lawsuits on behalf of consumers, even though there was absolutely no evidence that the consumers were misled in any way, because it was reported on the screen, but it technically violated the law, and so they were able to get class action settlements extracted in those cases.
As I recall, in that case, it took a change in the law to fix that that avenue, but it's a good example. Please go ahead, Dean.
Exactly.
I was just going to say we've got a couple more questions pending now, so let's take another call.
Very good. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Blake Taylor from the GW Regulatory Study Center. And
great.
I was going to ask your opinion on the, in general, and also about the disclosure requirements, about the merits and weaknesses of the prepaid debit card rule.
You want to start with that, Todd?
I do. Yes, for that rule. I think that it's 800 pages long or whatever. People are still trying to figure out exactly what's going on with that rule and what impact it's going to have. Most people focused on the limitations on the product features, such as overdraft protection. My sense is that the disclosure aspects of it are not that bad, and obviously moving in the direction of disclosure is not always a good idea, but it's better than substantive term restrictions or bans or that sort of thing. I think we'll have to sort of see how that plays out. The real concern was that they might, for instance, I think going in, the real concern was that they might actually try to design product features on cards and what they could offer and that sort of thing. And so in that sense, the disclosure aspects of it are pretty good. One thing that's very striking about that industry is as it's become more competitive and become more mainstream in some sense, that a lot of the arguments that it's a good example of a lot of the arguments that are being made for regulation even 3 or 4 years ago are now pretty much moot. The cards have become much cheaper. They've got fewer price points on them. There's a lot of cards out there that have just a flat annual fee and no other charges or no annual fee. And so I think, to some extent, it's an example of where I suspect the market is going in many ways might end up kind of mooting out the regulation that they had. And fortunately, the main thing is if fortunately they didn't try to design the cards and basically say you can only have, monthly fee cards without per transactions or fees or that sort of thing. But my sense is that with respect to the disclosure aspects of it, people feel like it's something they can live with. It probably won't do much good, but it may not do much harm either, is my impression, although certainly other people may have different impressions of that.
Great question. Thank you very much.
We've got one more question pending. After that, our lines are open. Push the star button and the pound button on your phone if you'd like to join the conversation. Let's now go to our next caller.
Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Mike. I'm Mike Doherty here in Atlanta. I'll mute in a second because I'm driving. But I chimed in late, so if I've it's been addressed, I apologize. What impact on the agency aggressiveness and almost like reigning in Elizabeth Warren do you think is going to have with a red Senate now? And especially with the red Senate maybe only being red till 16 with a lot of Republican candidates on the defense of the next election. Do you see anything being strangleholded or her being curtailed at all by the flip of the Senate?
Well, I'm happy to start that off, and Todd, I'm sure you have some views on it as well. One of the key things that a majority in the Senate gives you is the authority to set the agenda. And that's a very important thing. It determines what are the issues that you're looking at and how you're looking at them. The House has been using its authority as a majority to have a series of hearings for the last couple of years on the activities of the Bureau. And because of what the House has been doing, that's why we know about the overruns at the Bureau's building, how they're managing information, and some of the other problems. Having the Senate conduct similar kinds of investigations and inquiries, I think further puts activities of the Bureau in the spotlight and in the public that really need to be exposed. So I think there's that advantage in terms of the oversight. The second question was with regard to legislation. That's a tougher sell. I think to the extent that people can make a case that this or that bureau proposal, rule, or whatever actually harms customers rather than consumers rather than helps them, And if you can present that with good, hard information and hard data, I think there's a possibility that action can be taken in Congress. It'd be tough for people to oppose that. And maybe that's where some of the hearings can make the case for that this or that rule is actually having a negative effect. We're certainly seeing that in the mortgage area. As critiques have been raised and demonstrated with a lot of data, that some of the Bureau's mortgage rules are actually making it harder for creditworthy customers to get mortgages, the Bureau has gone back and made changes in their rules. And I think we could potentially see that with some other areas. In terms of significant changes in the structure of the Bureau, I think this particular Congress can begin that process. But right now, I think you have a president that would be eager to veto any of those efforts. But that doesn't mean you don't start it and see where it can go. Todd?
Yeah, well said, Wayne. I think that oversight can move the ball a little bit. We'll have to see how the Senate engages in it. The House, as you said, has been unusually effective, and they have an unusually talented and tenacious group of people. Jeb Hensarling is obviously a star with respect to his knowledge of this issue and his interest in this issue and his advocacy for consumers. Congressman McHenry on the House Oversight and Government Affairs Committee has also been really tenacious and knowledgeable about the CFPB and staying on top of their lack of accountability. And oversight, you gave examples on mortgages. If, in fact, Operation Choke Point is in retreat, that's another example of where oversight, I think, has been useful for consumers. But I think the big picture is that until there is true structural reform of putting some checks and balances on this agency, there's not that much that can be done, which is the agency, there's really no carrots or sticks that can be used to try to get the agency to be more responsive, to be more better for consumers in the like. And that's going to require legislation for that to actually be done. And obviously, one of the things that when this was set up, this bureau was set up in the way it was set up without any accountability or oversight. The point was to try to get it up and running and keep it running for as long as possible before some sort of trimming of its sails occurred. And they've managed to get a good long run out of it at this point and to entrench a lot of practices, a lot of regulations in the like. And that was obviously tied to the fact that they were going to make it basically without any sort of accountability. So I think that's going to still require some legislation down the road. And until we get the real structural reforms of checks and balances being put on budget, perhaps a bipartisan agency structure, there's only a limited amount that the House and Senate can do. And then to some extent, it also depends on whether the Senate oversight is as engaged and intelligent and as the House has been on this.
One more thought has come to mind as you've been speaking, Todd. I recall when the Federal Trade Commission was first set up, it was given very, very broad authorities and didn't have a whole lot of accountability compared to where it is today. And lack of accountability tends to breed hubris, and it's certainly due to the FTC. The FTC made some major blunders, and a Democrat Congress and Senate trimmed its sails and brought it back into a position where I think it's a rather responsible agency that is very careful with its mandate. And you could potentially see the Bureau make some very serious mistakes and create the right conditions for some legislative changes that are even supported by Democrats going forward. Potentially.
Right. Potentially.
We've got time for a final question. If there is one, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. And let me say that at least partially responsive to some of the caller's questions, there is a paper on the Federalist Society's webpage. The title of the paper is Can the Dodd-Frank Act Be Reformed to Strengthen the Financial System and the Overall Economy? We think so. That's a paper written by our guests today, Wayne Abernathy and Alex Pollack, another member of the Executive Committee of the Federalist Society. If you go to the Federalist Society's website and just search Dodd-Frank, that paper will pop up pretty promptly for you. We don't have a final question, gentlemen, so let me revert to each of you and see if you have a final thought before we conclude our call. Professor Zawicki, final thought?
We'll probably be tracking this arbitration story over the next few calls. So it's an important issue, obviously, and we'll probably have more to report next month. So,
Wayne Abernathy.
My final comment would be, I think the way to deal with the Bureau going forward, and I think it's been effective as an approach so far, is to continue to look at every issue in terms of what does it really mean, not what's it supposed to mean, what is the real effect on customers and consumers. And if you can come up with good data, good information, and what the real impact has been, you can get some changes and you can get some pushback and be successful in trying to get more reasonable outcomes. That's something we all need to continue to do.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. As always, look forward to hearing from you again in future calls discussing the CFPB, a very important topic. To our callers, thank you also for joining the call. A reminder about our next Teleform conference call scheduled for tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be talking about the intersection of free speech and religion. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.